Tonight on Arena, Chris Morrish brings us through the shortlist for this year's International Dublin Literary Award and new albums from Matt Berninger, Katie Malua and Paddy Hanna up for review. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. It's that time of year again when Dublin City Council is building up to the announcement next Thursday of the winner of this year's International Dublin Literary Award. The prize is worth €100,000 to the winner, and if the book is in translation, the author gets €75,000, the translator €25,000. The long list of 156 titles is created by library users all over the world. A judging panel whittles that down to 10, and from that 10, next Thursday's winner will be chosen. With me this evening, Chris Morrish, the chair of the judging panel, and we're planning, Chris, to work our way through the 10 shortlisted books to give listeners a flavour of what's involved in each one of them. But the International Dublin Literary Award itself, Chris, it's so unlike other prizes in many ways, but the big thing is the fact that the readers are given a voice in the choices here.
Yeah, that's right, Sean. I think that's the thing that I think it's really special about this. We have libraries in 119 cities around the world in 40 countries. That means there's an incredible reach. I mean, if you think of every library, you think your local library and the way in which it reaches out to so many members of the community in so many different ways, all of those people are feeding into that long list. So I think there's probably no other literary award in the world, really, I'll go out on a limb and say that, that has such a reach in terms of how it draws its short or its long list up.
And it's not surprising then that on the shortlist we have a number of books that have already won big prizes, which may have brought readers to them in the first place.
Yes, we do. I mean, this is the thing I love about this is, you know, when we go through the long list, we have a Nobel laureate here. We have a book that's already won the Booker. At the same time, we have two first-time novelists on here. And because it's libraries and because it's local libraries, there are books that might not be on people's radar that a reader somewhere picks up on and can nominate, and it can make its way into the long list and from the long list to the short list. So it really is an award that kind of levels the playing field.
The other thing that really struck me looking at the shortlist of 10 writers, particularly this year, is the variety, the diversity that is there in terms of gender, in terms of race, ethnicity, geography, right across the board. Debut novelists and, as you said, award-winning novelists, very experienced novelists as well. How accidental is that diversity in the 10 shortlisted books?
I think it's telling, actually. I think it's something that tells me something about the state of the novel. As the chair of the judging panel, one of the first things I'd say to the judges is, look, we're not here to try to produce a particular kind of shortlist. We have no quota in terms of gender, ethnicity, race, geography, anything like that. You're just here to try and find the best 10 best novels we can find, and from that, the best one. What is interesting is using that criteria, we ended up with a shortlist, and as we go through it, we'll see a shortlist where 8 of the 10 are women, 4 of those are women of color, and of the 2 men, one is a Native American, and one is a gay man. So there isn't a single kind of, white, straight, middle-aged male writer on the shortlist, and that's not intentional, but I think it tells us where the novel's going.
But it must have been a joy to see that when you looked at the 10 shortlisted books.
Yeah, I felt sort of proud, I thought, okay, we produced a really interesting, diverse shortlist here. But I think what it also tells us is that there are certain kinds of stories that haven't been told, or there have been stories that haven't been told in certain ways. And those stories are starting to be told now. So what we'll see on the shortlist are novels that take some stories we think we know and change the perspective in such a way that it becomes a completely new story.
Well, let's take a look at the specifics then of the 10 books. And we will talk a little bit about each book so that we show no favour.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We need to be clear on that. And the order we've chosen is alphabetical in terms of titles. So there's no significance in which books we hear from first or hear talk about first, second, third, or indeed last. So the first one that we'll be speaking about, All the Lives We Never Lived. Anuradha Roy is the Indian writer that we have here. This is set against the background background of World War II and Indian independence, Chris.
It is, yes. And but it again, it's this thing of changing perspective. I mean, it starts out with the perspective of a small boy, this boy Mishkin, who is kind of watching his world and watching his world, things happening in his world that he doesn't quite understand. But it also, it kind of has a kind of reach. I mean, it brings us, you know, not just to India, but to Dutch-controlled Bali in the 1930s. It has the feel of an historical epic, but an historical epic that's filtered through the eyes of a small boy initially. And that's what gives it a freshness. There's also real engagement there with Indian literature as well. I mean, there's the kind of figures, major figures from Indian literature kind of make their way into the novel as well.
And I suppose it's always a question in and around historical fiction, you know, where does the history end and the fiction begin? Did you get involved in the kind of balance involved there? Or is that indeed part of the discussions that you might be having now as you're talking about the shortlist?
I think it is. I mean, I suppose it's not so much trying to measure the book against an historical reality, but it's how vividly it brings you into that world. And one of the things this book does, you know, gives you a world that's palpable. You can feel it. You can smell it. You can, you know, you can scent the trees. You really get a sense of what this world is like. And to me, that's what a great novel does.
Great. And indeed, the book has been long listed for the Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction in 2018. She herself was long listed for the Man Booker, International Man Booker, or the Man Booker Prize in 2015. So a lot of experience and a lot of success already there. Let's move on then to An American Marriage. Tiare Jones is the writer here. Really, we're dealing with the incarceration, mass incarceration of African-American men in America, Chris. And the story's a brilliantly named characters, I have to say here. Roy Othaniel Hamilton and his wife, Celestial Gloriana.
I know, they're great names, aren't they? It really, if you want to know why there are Black Lives Matter protests happening, I mean, there's, you know, we've lots of reasons we know why, but if you want to know that from the inside, this is a novel that brings you into that world, because, you know, here are two African American people, a married couple, their lives are you know, are really heading in the right direction. I mean, Roy has this great kind of monologue where he talks about going to university, and, you know, everything's going well, and then he's arrested wrongfully, and it's about how that world comes apart. And you feel the injustice of it. You don't have to be, you know, told this is unjust. You
right.
feel it.
Well, let's listen to a clip from the book that will give us a sense of that, An American Marriage. And it's the voice of the narrator, Roy, here, and the actor reading the part is Kwaku Fortune.
However, she sleeps in the very house she grew up in. I, on the other hand, departed on the first thing smoking. Exactly 71 hours after high school graduation. I would have left sooner, but the trailways had passed you Elo every day. By the time the mailman brought my mama the cardboard tube containing my diploma, I was all moved into my dorm room at Morehouse College, attending a special program for first-generation scholarship types. We were invited to show up 2.5 months before the legacies to get the lay of the land and bone up on the basics. Imagine. 23 young black men watching Spike Lee's School Days and Sidney Poitier's To Sir With Love on loop, and you either will or will not get the picture. Indoctrination isn't always a bad thing. Atlanta is where I learned the rules. I learned them quick. Ain't nobody call me stupid. But home isn't where you land. Home is where you launch. You can't pick your home no more than you can choose your family.
Kwaku Fortune there, reading from Tiare Jones's novel, An American Marriage, the second of the 10 shortlisted books for the International Dublin Literary Award. We're discussing all 10 with the chair of the judging panel, Chris Moresh, this evening. Let's move on to Disoriental. Debut novel, this one, Chris, from a writer called Negar Javadi. This is the only book, I think, in translation on the shortlist this year, isn't it?
No, we have two others.
I beg your pardon. We'll
flag them when we get to them.
Yes.
This is one of two. This is one of two first-time novels, and it's a remarkable debut. Negar Javadi she's French-Iranian, I suppose would be the description. I mean, she lives in Paris, writes in French, but her family are Iranian. And there's a kind of quasi-autobiographical quality to this. I mean, if you think you know the kind of history of Iran. Read this book, because it kind of, again, brings you into that history. The main character, her grandfather was born in a harem in the mountains, and it's just, you know, completely other world. And then her father's an intellectual who, first of all, is involved in the revolt against the Shah, and then after the Iranian Revolution, is in rebellion against the Islamic regime in Iran. So it's somebody who's on the wrong side of things all the time.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the important, very important issues in the book is the central character, Kimia, a tomboy in a society that certainly doesn't recognise the phenomenon of tomboyedness.
Well, I mean, that's how she appears when she's younger. They just think she's a tomboy. Mm. I mean, she's bisexual, effectively, and she's a character who, you know, has a kind of ambiguous sexuality, and this puts her in tension with the kind of society that she comes from, particularly some of the older members of the society. But then, of course, she begins to realize that, in fact, you know, one of her uncles is in fact gay, and that there is a kind of gay life in Iran, the Iran that she comes from. I mean, it gives you a very, very palpable sense of that intellectual culture of dissent in Iran, and just what a lively thing that is.
Let's move on then. That's book number 3 of the 10 shortlisted books on this year's International Dublin Literary Award. Book number 4, Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead. Great title. Olga Tokarczuk is the Polish writer involved here. Her novel Flights was awarded the International Man Booker in 2018. But she's been castigated in her homeland of Poland for her outspoken feminism. What is she exploring in this book, Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead, Chris?
Yeah, it's a great title, isn't it? That's actually a line from William Blake. She also won the Nobel Prize in 2018. So here, you know, here we just went from Javadi, a first-time novelist, to Tokarczuk, who is, you know, a Nobel laureate. So this is the kind of range we have here. This is a wonderful novel. I mean, it starts off, I mean, and it looks like, you know, starts off like a lot of good novels with a dead body. So initially you think, okay, there's a mystery here. But you have a narrator who is wonderfully unreliable in a sense. You know, she starts off, you know, she wakes up and she's confused. She talks about her illnesses and her condition. And you're led through this world where she is very much a kind of a critic of the society in which she lives. Mm. And that's very much contemporary Poland. You know, the Poland that is very much leaning towards the right in various ways.
The other thing that the other quality that the narrator has, the Janina, is that she has a touch of a Miss Marple about her, an Eastern European Miss Marple, because it seems at one level like a murder mystery, but there's a lot more going on.
There's a lot more going on. It's also very funny. I mean, it's a very funny novel because you have this character who sees the world at a slightly skewed angle. And I think, I mean, you know, we were saying at the top of the program about the ways in which I think the novel is showing us things we think we know in a different way. And this is a classic example of that. Here we have a character or a narrator who sees the world just slightly askew.
Yeah. Okay. That's book number 4 then, Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead. Book number 5, and indeed here it is, the second of the 3 books in translation, first published in French in 2016, History of Violence by Edward Louis. Lauren Steen is the translator here. I spoke to Edward Louis about his book, The End of Eddie. It's very autobiographical, about his own impoverished childhood. The History of Violence, similar ground being mined here, autobiographical material, Chris?
Yes, it is. I mean, Edward Louis is he's a kind of classic French intellectual in a funny way. I mean, he grew up in a fairly poor background, gay, you know, very, very strongly on the left. I mean, edited a book on Pierre Bourdieu. I mean, he's, you know, so he's very, you know, wrote a manifesto published in Le Monde. So he's that kind of Parisian public intellectual. This is a harrowing book. I mean, this is really a disturbing book in a way. A young gay man on his way home in Paris one night brings home a stranger who subsequently rapes him.
I tell you, let's listen to a clip, in fact, which describes the kind of fear that the narrator is living, is under. He's in fear for his life in this section, read from History of Violence by Johnny Ward.
It wasn't yet light out. The street was empty. I was alone. And as I stumbled along, though I had such a short way to go, I found myself counting in my haste. Just 50 more steps. Keep going. Just 20 more steps. And you're there. I hurried faster. and my impatience for the future, which would somehow or other dispatch, consign, reduce this scene to the past, I found myself thinking, in a week, you'll say it's been a whole week since it happened. Keep going. And in a year, you'll say it's been a whole year since it happened. The drops of freezing rain weren't beating down, but fell in a thin, clammy drizzle that soaked through the canvas of my shoes. The water oozed its way through my insoles and the fabric of my socks. I was cold, and I thought, he could come back. He's bound to come back. Now I can never go home. He's driven me from my home.
Johnny Ward there reading from Edward Louis's History of Violence, one of the fifth of the shortlisted books on this year's International Dublin Literary Awards, discussing the shortlist with chair of the judging panel, Chris Morris. You really pick up the fear even off that section that we heard read there, Chris.
You do, and it's you know, it's about the trauma of suffering an attack. It's also, I think, the kind of conflicting feelings that the narrator feels afterwards. You know, he feels guilty sometimes for turning in the person who attacked him to the police. He's the young man who attacks him is a Berber. The police call him an Arab. So he becomes involved in the kind of racial politics of it. It's a very, very powerful and complex novel.
This one, I think, would be familiar to lots of listeners to this programme. The Milkman, book number 6. Anna Barnes, a Northern Irish writer, Booker Prize winner in 2019. Very distinctive style. How would you describe the style of Anna Barnes in this novel, Chris Morrish?
I think, again, if a great novel is a world, it creates its own world. This is a novel that does that. And again, it's this thing of taking something we think we know and just changing the perspective. I mean, we've all read lots of Troubles fiction, lots of novels about conflict in Northern Ireland. This just takes that, takes it to another level by giving us another perspective, the perspective of this character who lives in this intensely insular world. So, you know, you get the opening line, you know, the day somebody makes somebody put a gun to my breast. You know, none of the characters have names. There's somebody like makes somebody, second sister's husband. Nobody has a proper name because everybody knows who everybody is. It just creates this sense of a claustrophobic enclosed community with a really powerful intensity.
And really comments on the Northern Irish Troubles, but in an oblique way, in a way that I haven't seen done before about that particular topic.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, I suppose it also just won the Ewart Briggs Award as well. Beating out Derry Girls, which is no mean feat.
Certainly not. Belfast versus Derry, that's a big battle. Let's move on to book number 7, The Friend, from Sigrid Nunez. Who is the friend in question here?
The friend in question is a Great Dane. this is a wonderful novel.
Not a Shakespearean character, a dog.
No, it's a dog. Sigrid Nunez is, again, she's an intensely New York writer. I mean, she's somebody who writes for The New Yorker, The New Yorker Review of Books, very much involved in that writerly world. And this is a novel about a character who very much inhabits that world, or sort of on the edges of it, who is friends with this older male writer who, you know, is sort of a generation of writers who does all sorts of politically incorrect things in terms of having relationships with people and so on. And this is not giving a whole lot away because it happens the first page. He dies and he wills her his Great Dane. And so we have this novel that's about grief, it's about friendship, it's about literature, and it's about dogs. And it's just a wonderful novel.
It's also a book about creative writing, and it starts to examine how some people might feel the Me Too campaign has silenced or certainly made some writers nervous about what they're doing. That's a moot point that will anger people, even the point being made.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's the dog acts as a kind of metaphor in a very, very kind of clear way. It's like, you know, imagine somebody willed you a Great Dane. I mean, you'd love it, but it would also be a bit of an encumbrance and a bit of a nuisance and a bit of an embarrassment. And this is kind of the way the friend is. This friend of hers who has died is somebody who, you know, she recognizes would be on the wrong side of Me Too in lots of ways, and yet she was close to him, that he was a friend. Mm. And the dog is a bit like that.
Good way of making the point through the mouth of a dog, I guess. Book number 8 then, The Silence of the Girls, Pat Barker. We spoke to Pat Barker as well when The Silence of the Girls was published. This is her take on the Iliad, and she's done something very important here. We always hear the story from the point of view of the boys who are doing the fighting. This is the story reclaimed for the women involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's this thing of taking a story we think we know. I mean, you know, is there any story we think we know any better than the Trojan War, and telling it from the perspective of one of the female characters, a character named Briseis, who's taken as a captive and basically given to Achilles. What Barker does with this is really remarkable, because, you know, she's a writer who writes war better than anybody. I mean, if you know any of her, you know, her books about the First World War, you know, Regeneration, The Ghost Road, I mean, they're harrowing battle sequences in those books. Well, here she does the same thing with the Trojan War, but from the perspective of this female character.
Yeah. Let's hear a bit of that perspective, the narrator Briseis, read here by Shauna Kerslake.
I noticed Ismene, who was 4 months pregnant with my husband's child, pressing her hands hard into her stomach, trying to convince herself the pregnancy didn't show. In the past few days, I'd often seen her looking at me. Ismene, who'd once been so careful never to meet my eyes. And her expression had said, more clearly than any words, "It's your turn now. Let's see how you like it." It hurt, that rash, unblinking stare. I came from a family where slaves were treated kindly. And when my father gave me in marriage to Mines, the king, I carried on that tradition in my own home. I'd been kind to Ismene. Or I thought I had. But perhaps no kindness was possible between owner and slave, only varying degrees of brutality. I looked across the room at Ismene and thought, yes, you're right.
Shauna Kerslake there, reading from The Silence of the Girls by Pat Barker. 2 to go, Chris Morris. Let's go through them. They're There by Tommy Orange. Interesting title, that. Gertrude Stein gave him that. Her childhood city of Oakland, California. A link, I presume, with that city in the book?
There is, very much. But again, not in Oakland, California that we think we know, if we think we know Oakland, California. Tommy Orange is a member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. So he's a Native American. And this novel actually had the most nominations of any novel on the list. It was nominated by 13 libraries. It's a first-time novel, which again is remarkable. And he's writing about what he calls urban Indians, about the Native American peoples who are living in cities, living in places like Oakland. It has a kind of structure of a crime novel. There's a kind of elaborate heist that the plot revolves around. But really, it's about the lives of people who are, in some ways, displaced. You know, people for whom there is no there.
Let's move on to the final book, Washington Black. He's at that book is there because of the title, beginning with W. Essie Aduyan, the author here. An 11-year-old field slave who knows no other life than the Barbados sugar plantation where he was born. What is Aduyan giving us in this novel, Chris?
Aduyan is doing something wonderful with this novel. This is like the kind of the big adventure novels of the 19th century. This is like Jules Verne. Mm. This is like H. Rider Haggard. Except the protagonist is a young African-American slave named Titch. The opening section is harrowing. I mean, it's a harrowing of life on a plantation. And Titch is taken out of this, and he ends up in this kind of world of adventure and, you know, hot air balloons, and he ends up in Morocco and the Arctic. And it's just a wonderfully enjoyable novel. I mean, I saw somebody picking one up in a bookshop in Dublin the other day, and I said, buy it. You'll love it.
You've had great joy, obviously, reading all 10 of them and enjoying all 10 of them. And you're the non-voting chair, so you don't have to get into that decision, like Christopher. But you can listen to the great discussions that will be had over the coming week. That's Christopher Morash. Thank you very much for bringing us through the shortlist there, Chris. And the winner of the International Dublin Literary Award will be announced on Thursday next. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Wells, writer of novels, plays and musicals, will forever be remembered as the inventor of Jeeves and Wooster, one of the funniest double acts undoubtedly in English literature. His invention didn't end there, of course. He's responsible for a whole cast of comic creations, including Lord Emsworth of Blanding's Castle, Roderick Spode of the Oswald Musley send-up, and one of the most marvellous fictional aunts ever, Aunt Agatha. It's no small honour and responsibility then to be given the mantle of the new author of the Tales of Jeeves and Wooster by the Woodhouse Estate. Ben Schott has been given just that task and has published Jeeves and the Leap of Faith, which is his second novel, featuring the autocratic butler and his hapless charge. Declan Burke has been reading it for us, and we'll hear what Declan thought of it shortly. But first of all, let's get we got a flavour of the theme tune there of the BBC TV series from 1990, a few minutes ago. Let's hear Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie now as Jeeves and Wooster from the same series. And not for the first time, they do battle over Bertie's wardrobe.
Pardon me for asking, sir, but are you proposing to appear in public in those garments?
Well, certainly, Jeeves. But a bit vivid, do you think?
Not necessarily, sir. I'm told that Mr. Freddy, he's a riot flower dew, often appears on the music hall stage in comparable attire. But
No buts, Jeeves. I happen to think very highly of them.
There we go. Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie as Jeeves and Wooster in the BBC series from 1990. Pelham Grenville, P.G. Woodhouse, born in Surrey in 1881, died in Long Island in 1975, known as Plum to his friends. He was a huge success as an author in his lifetime. Evelyn Waugh, no less, called him the master. Declan Burke, as I said, reading the book for us, and a man with an interest in Jeeves and Wooster himself. First of all, the master. Is Evelyn Waugh right about that? Or Evelyn Waugh right about that, Declan?
I certainly think he was, Sean. I mean, he was describing him as the master in a particular context, and he was talking about his ability to write these comic masterpieces. But for shorthand, people tend to use the phrase the master. And look, he was an absolute master of the comic novel, not just a novel, as you said in the intro, to musical plays and all manner of kind of humorous writing. A wonderful variety of styles, and always beautifully light, always beautifully gently absurd. These kind of, he used to describe his writing as musical comedy without the music, and that kind of sums up his ability to kind of sidestep out of reality and create these wonderful fairy tales in which time seems to stand still.
Jeeves and Wooster, though, they really are the top end of his creations.
They are. They tend to take place, the stories tend to take place in around the early 1930s, Sean, in that kind of interwar period in which, you know, people could still believe that all was going to be well, and particularly those of the class of Bertie Wooster, who never seems to have worked a day in his life, but is always very well provided for in the matter of the old simoleons. And he tends to drift from one club to another and having a tifter here and so forth, and getting into scrapes, and ended up being, you know, engaged to women that he always seems to think are unsuitable for his purposes. Well, he just doesn't want to get married. That's full stop. And then we have Jeeves, as we heard in the clip, who is vastly more intelligent than his upper class employer, and much more eloquent and so forth, and always manages to quietly steer Bertie away from his latest disaster without having the time, without Bertie even realising he was on the brink of disaster.
Woodhouse himself, 96 books he wrote, staggering achievement, obviously, and clearly he enjoyed his work. So he was very seldom in trouble outside, and the fun of his books, I suppose, people just had fun with that. But he did land himself in a little trouble, first of all, with the Inland Revenue. But the big controversial incident, which kind of feeds into the book, which we found out later, was he was interned by the Nazis during World War II and made some very naive broadcasts. What happened there? How was he so naive?
Well, I think naive is the crucial word here. He was living in France when the war broke out for tax reasons, as far as I understand, and was interned as a non-combatant. And while he was interned, he did an interview with the New York Times about his time in being interned. And as a result, the USCBS corporation that were based in Berlin persuaded him to do some broadcast to America, talking about his experience of being interned and what it was like to be a prisoner of, not quite a prisoner of war, but under German a prisoner of Germany, and he agreed to do it. And it's this naivety that I think that you have alluded to, and this sense of not being quite in the world that persuaded him to go ahead. And he did five broadcasts, which were, as you can imagine, there were mixed reviews stateside, and of course it quickly filtered back to the UK, and there was outrage. And he was condemned as a collaborator, as a traitor. It was very much a Lord Ho-Ho kind of scenario that he was being accused of. And as soon as he heard that this was the reaction, he immediately ceased and tried to be released from Germany, which was impossible. After the war, I mean, MI5 investigated him. He was held by the French and he was investigated and so forth. And he was cleared of all charges, of all charges, really, bar kind of stupidity and ignorance. George Orwell famously wrote that, you know, P.G. Wodehouse could not be accused of any kind of political awareness. One only has to read one of his novels to become clear on that. So, you know, it's this naivety, this sense of the fact that he lived outside the reality of the world that kind of catapulted him into this Bertie-like disaster.
Yeah, but he did redeem his reputation subsequent to all of that. And I guess that fascism side of things directly feeds into the Roderick Spode character of Wodehouse himself, but and that in turn feeds into what Ben Schott has done in this new novel, Jeeves and the Leap of Faith.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the story starts off, Ben Schott's second stab at the Wodehouse oeuvre, starts out with the Drones Club in all kinds of trouble, Sean. This is very important, and they're going to the wall, so Bertie has to try and step in and bring Jeeves in to come up with a solution. But the main plot revolves around a revelation from the previous Ben Schott novel, in which we're told that Jeeves has all along, and his Ganymede Club, have been an important part of the British Secret Service. And in this novel, Bertie is kind of co-opted by the British Secret Service to go to Cambridge to sabotage Roderick Spode, whose saviours of Britain, his black-shorted saviours of Britain, are on the march yet again. And Spode is about to make a big speech, and it's up to Bertie to kind of put a spoke in his wheels.
Wodehouse famous for his one-liners, and Schott obviously has to write in the style. I presume he's writing in the style of Wodehouse. Do you have a favourite Wodehouse one-liner, or were there any Schott one-liners that struck you?
Well, I mean, I do. We could be here all week, Sean. My favourite Wodehouse one-liner is from Enter Smith, actually, in which this kind of raffish, loquacious character introduces himself. "I am Smith," said the old Etonian reverently. "There is a preliminary P before the name. This, however, is silent. Like the tomb, compare such words as ptarmigan, Sam, and Thysis." And that's the kind of humour, that gentle kind of mocking of, you know, the slightly upper-class twits that always has characterised the Wodehouse style. Ben Schott is obviously a student and a scholar, because we have lines like, "Despite more than a passing resemblance to a befreckled Pekingese, there was much to commend Miss Stoker as a permanent romantic feature." So he's definitely doing his best to resurrect the Wodehouse one-liner. I don't think he's quite there, but it's also important to remember, you know, he's not trying to replicate P.G. Wodehouse. This is very much, as he says in his own
Have we lost you there, Dex? We've lost you there, Declan. And I'll tell you what, we'll just go to our break. Jeeves and the Leap of Faith, unfortunately, Declan gone from us there. Jeeves and the Leap of Faith by Ben Schott is published by Hutchinson. And so to Friday's album reviews. First up will be Matt Berninger, best known as the singer in The National. He's just released a solo album called Serpentine Prison. Georgian British singer and songwriter Katie Malua shot to fame in 2013 with her debut album, hugely successful, Call Off the Search. She gives us album number 8 today, and it's called album number 8. Finally, Irish singer-songwriter Paddy Hanna releases an album he has described as internal music, exploring issues around mental health. The album is called The Hill. Lauren Murphy and John Maher have been listening. We'll speak to both of them shortly, but first of all, let's hear from Berninger. The album, as I said, Serpentine Prison, and this is a track called One More Second.
Baby, don't lie to me, you know that I believe you. Always in love with someone, if it ain't me, come on. Just give me a little more time, give me a little bit of warning. Baby, I'm gonna be fine when I figure out where I'm going.
One More Second, the title of that track from Matt Berninger from his album Serpentine Prison. Lauren Murphy and John Maher have been listening, as I said. He originally envisioned this, John Maher, as an album of cover versions. So how did it change from that into the album that we got?
And he did indeed. And in fact, the producer of this album is Booker T. Jones, the Memphis legend, who produced Willie Nelson's album of covers from 1978, Stardust, one of the great examples of the genre, and an album that Matt Berninger adored. And he had worked with Jones about a decade ago, and 2 years ago he decided that he wanted to make this album of covers and went into studio with Jones, and they laid about 7 or 8 covers down. And he, while he was there, he said, look, I've got a few originals, let's work on them as well. So the covers apparently will see light of day when the deluxe version of this album comes out later in the year. But they're all originals, and it's a good thing because they're really, really special.
And Lauren, I guess when people hear the name Matt Berninger and it's a solo project, they're going to say, well, how much of the national sound are we going to get in here? Are we going to hear a different Matt Berninger? What are we getting?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. I mean, he obviously has a very distinctive voice and also a very distinctive lyrical style, is often, you know, quite sort of oblique lyrics. I was wondering if you might try and change that up for this record, but the very first line on the song, on the album, the first song, has the line, "My eyes are t-shirts, they're so easy to read." So, you know, definitely still oblique to a certain extent. I guess the biggest difference between this and a national record for me was that this is a lot more low-key. It's a lot more ruminative and very understated. And the National do understated really well on some songs, definitely. But, I mean, when you have musicians of their calibre, and especially a drummer as good as Brian Devendorf in your band, you're going to use them. But these songs often have, they take away the, you know, the big powerful surges and the rhythms and strip it all back. It's all about atmosphere and keeping things mostly low-key. It's pared back in a lot of respects, I guess, to a normal national album.
Yeah, and perhaps, John Maher, we hear Berninger's voice in a way we don't always hear it in the midst of a big national mix, if you like. But he's not the only voice that we're hearing here. Gail-Ann Dorsey is present as well. Who is she?
She is, of course, people will know Gail-Ann Dorsey as a member of David Bowie's band for the latter decades of his life, a bassist with him. And she also appears on I Am Easy to Find, which is the most recent national album. And her vocals are really beautiful here, and they complement Berninger's croon. As Lauren says, this is a very ruminative album. There are people that love the National will wonder, is there a Mr. November here and a kind of chaotic, frantic song of that ilk? And there isn't. It's very much an album for quiet meditation. It's a very personal album. He's laying demons bare and doing so well. One thing that's interesting is that his wife, Corinne Besser, a former editor at The New Yorker, co-writes a lot of the songs with him for The National, but she doesn't appear here at all. Instead, he works with people like Walter Martin of the Walkmen, Brent Knopf and Matt Sheehy of Elvi. That's his other band.
Right.
They released an album about 5 years ago. So there's a solo album in name, but there's a lot of people involved.
Hey, well, let's listen to the track that one of the tracks that features Gail-Ann Dorsey. This is a track called Silver Springs.
Everyone knows where to hang, but they never show you the ropes. You get hit by a car, shot by a cousin, or slip off a boat. One of these days, the sky's gonna rain, so why are you crying? I wanna meet you somewhere right now, in the dandelions. Sit down, grow up, drive slow.
There you go, the sound there of Silver Springs, Gail-Ann Dorsey and Matt Berninger. Matt Berninger is the album owner, if you like, Gail-Ann Dorsey duetting with him on that track. Did this work overall for you, John Maher, and stars, please?
It absolutely did. Look, I adore The National. I think this guy is a gifted songwriter, and I've been listening to this album for the last few weeks and loving it, so it's all 5 for me.
All 5 from John Maher. Lauren, are you in a 5-star mood tonight?
It's very rare that I give out 5 stars. This definitely comes close. I mean, it's a gorgeously crafted album. He's such a great songwriter, as John said, and I loved it more with every listen. So maybe a few more listens, it might graduate to a 5, but I'll give it a strong 4 for now.
A very strong 4 from Lauren Murphy. Let's move on to album number 2, Katie Melua, an album called Album Number 8, her 8th album, obviously. The opening track is A Love Like That. Go, how do you make a love like that? Last is the lyric, A Love Like That is the song from Katie Melua and her album number 8, which she has just released. I suppose, Lauren, when I think of Katie Melua, I immediately think of 9 Million Bicycles in Beijing very early. I was thinking from her second album. Huge success from her first 2 albums. Has she ever matched the success? It was a hard success to match, it has to be said, that early success.
Yeah, she was enormously successful with those first albums, as you said. She has been really successful over the years. She hasn't maybe crossed over to the mainstream in the same way. I mean, she's at album number 8, so she's obviously maintained a career until now. I have to admit that I'd been quite dismissive of her over the years. I wasn't even sure that she was making music until this album landed in my inbox. So, she went from someone that you couldn't escape as a teenager with those songs to someone who's maintained a career over 8 albums. So, you know, fair dues to her. I was surprised. I had low expectations for this album, but it surprised me. It was way better than I expected. Not as one-dimensional as I expected either.
And that lyric, John Mayer, How Do You Make a Love Like That Last, that kind of, in some ways, is the theme of the entire album. Many of the songs on the album dealing with breakup, really.
Yeah, and very much looking inward, because her marriage ended and she's going through divorce, and the songs are about that, and I suppose about looking at a new life. And what's interesting about them is there's very little rancor. You know, she's in contemplative mode. I suppose for a musician that would have been considered the epitome of middle-of-the-road safeness, that's no surprise. But what is surprising, and I must say I would echo what Lauren said, the songs are good. I mean, her voice works beautifully. There's a maturity here that absolutely wasn't there at the past. But to be fair to her, in the middle years of the noughties, she was about 20 years old. Mike Batt of the Wombles was the man behind her early success, and she was pushed far and fast and maybe wasn't ready for it. But there is a fine artist underneath all of that, once you get away from the prejudices and that the name Katie Melua still brings.
And she has that very gentle voice, but there are big arrangements here. We're talking about the Georgian Philharmonic Orchestra. She went back to her roots to get these arrangements from Leo Abrahams. She can rise above the big, lush arrangements, Lauren.
Yeah, and I actually think her voice really suits them as well. She has this really, again, to use the word understated, but it matches her voice really well. And those string arrangements by Leo Abrahams, who is someone that you wouldn't necessarily expect to work with someone like Katie Melua either. I mean, he's done loads of film composition, and he's seen as kind of Brian Eno's protege by some. So he's worked with loads of, like, Regina Spektor and Wild Beasts over the years. So he's an unusual pairing to work with her, but it really works. And those really gorgeous big arrangements really work on this album.
Let's have a listen to a track a little bit further down the track listing. Second last track on the album, actually. This is Airtime.
Give me something to sparks. Not more about the fading light. Oh, get the dance moves right. Remember laughter. Voices in the night. Tell me you're gonna be fine.
Yeah, Yes, it gives it away there, doesn't it? Voices in the Night is the song that I played there rather than Airtime that I had in my head. But Lexi, let me go to Lauren Murphy on this one. Lauren, her voice, I kept thinking Karen Carpenter at different points along the way, many other artists of that ilk. There were a few names that came to your mind, I think, as well.
Yeah, there was a big 1970s influence running through this album for me, and artists like Carole King, even maybe not vocally, but definitely the piano style balladry that Carole King was so brilliant at. Norah Jones, you know, like is a kind of evergreen comparison for someone like Katie Melua with that sort of soft jazzy stuff. Eva Cassidy, that's kind of, she's been an omnipresent as an influence in her career as well. So, but the 70s stuff, like you said, Karen Carpenter, that really struck me because, again, I wasn't expecting it. So that was another thing that caught me by surprise for sure.
So you came with low expectations. Did you leave in a much happier state?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an intimate album in a lot of ways, but it's still maybe a little bit too nice, a bit too safe for its own good. There's not a huge amount of risks, so I need to listen a bit more again to make my mind up. But I certainly didn't dislike it. I didn't dislike it for sure.
You didn't dislike it. Well, how many stars are you going to give it for not disliking it?
I'll go with a 3 out of 5.
3. What are you saying, John Marr?
I'm saying 3 as well. I think there are some very fine songs, English Manor and Airtime. People should check them out after this show. But there are eminently skippable tracks as well. Despite the pretty orchestration and the nocturnal feel, some of it just is very forgettable. But the good stuff is very good.
All right. And what did you say, sorry, John, in terms
three
of stars?
3 stars from me. Three stars from you.
Okay, let us move on then to our final album this evening, an album from Paddy Hannah, Dublin musician, a favourite among critics and music aficionados in the capital and beyond. His third solo album is called The Hill. Let's listen to a track called Sinatra.
One more cry to show the final old. Bye. I'll die before the light is leaving. Once for the thousand that I loved ever so.
There you go, song called Sinatra from Paddy Hannah and his third solo album, which is called The Hill. Just tell us a little bit about Paddy Hannah for those outside the Dublin music scene who maybe don't know him, Lauren Murphy.
Yeah, so this is his third solo album. He's kind of, as you said, a stalwart of the Dublin indie pop scene at this point. He's been in loads of bands from the Popgal Island Collective over the years, including, you know, Grand Pocket Orchestra even, and Skellacrats. And he's currently actually in an indie pop band called Outremond as well. But he's been releasing solo albums since Leafy Stiletto in 2013. And that was an album that really set him apart as a writer of really quirky alt-pop songs, but with real depth too. At the same time, he's very much remained a bit of an outsider. You know, he's certainly not mainstream, but there's nothing wrong with that either.
I guess that song that we just heard there, John Marr, Sinatra, it probably is about as mainstream as the album actually gets. It's the most kind of straightforward pop song on there, isn't it?
It is. It's a fantastic tune. But there are also other great songs on this. And I'm reminded a little of the, I suppose that word, horrible word, cult, but cult Swedish songwriter Jens Lekman, in terms of some of his arrangements and lyrics, and there's a real kookiness to the material. It's also very difficult to categorise. I mean, you might kind of say this guy is a singer-songwriter, but there's a lot happening here, and you've also got the rhythm section of Girl Band, fantastic band, helping out in terms of the arrangement. So there's a lot of texture and instrumentation and some very good and unusual songs.
Yeah, singer-songwriter. You interviewed him, actually, Lauren, and tell us about the particular genre of film of which he's an aficionado.
Yeah, he was talking about how his love of obscure horror films, very specifically Italian horror films from the 1970s, played a role in this album. But that makes complete sense. It sounds like a totally bizarre reference point, but you can hear it on so many of those tracks. Like, there's a track called Cannibals that you can hear it on. And, you know, this album is very much about atmosphere and ambience, and it's very soundtracky in parts. There's a lot of melody in there too, but it's certainly not a straightforward indie pop album by any means.
Yeah, and even in the opening track, The Last of Their Kind, it's almost like a film score, and that comes up in different songs along the way as well. Let us finish up then, John Marr, with your stars for Paddy Hannah and The Hill.
Yeah, I think this is a very, very good album. It's a solid 4 from me.
Solid 4 from you. And what are you saying, Lauren Murphy, finally?
Yeah, I really liked it as well. It's unusual but intriguing. So 4 out of 5 from me too.
4 out of 5 from you. Well, you both had a good time with your albums this weekend, this week it would seem. We spoke just now about Paddy Hannah and The Hill. Before that, about Katie Melua and album number 8. And the first album this evening was Matt Berninger and Serpentine Prison. And indeed, that is our lot for this evening and for this week here on Arena. Leah Murphy, Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Cara O'Hare was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.